the possibility that one can construct a theory of quantum gravity in four dimensions. That theory is going to be based on a fourth order derivative equation of motion. The theory is called conformal gravity. The interest in conformal gravity is that it provides a natural solution to the cosmological constant problem. I had talked about this in PASCAS 07, though I suspect that none of you were at that talk. So let me very quickly state that the cosmological constant problem basically boils down to, can you find a symmetry that will make it zero at the level of the Lagrangian, and then can you find a way of controlling it after you break the symmetry? There are two known ways to do that. One, supersymmetry, the other is conformal gravity. Supersymmetry, when you break it, gives you a TeV scale cosmological constant. Conformal gravity, when you break it, also gives you a TeV scale cosmological constant, but it came without a fundamental G. And the result of that is that the cosmological constant is big, but it couples to geometry with a much smaller strength than it would do in a theory with a fundamental G. And so you don't solve the cosmological constant problem by making lambda small. Since you measure omega lambda, which is G times lambda, you solve the problem by making G small. But you pay a price. The price is you have a fourth order derivative theory, and fourth order derivative theories are notoriously thought to be non-unitary. So the two problems that we really face today, big problems, are the cosmological constant and quantum gravity. A string theory nicely solves the quantum gravity, but has problems with the cosmological constant problem. Conformal gravity nicely solves the cosmological constant problem, but appears to have problems with quantum gravity, with the unitarity problem. The purpose of this talk is to tell you that, in fact, there are no problems at all. The work that I'm going to describe is some work that I've been doing with Carl Bender. The first real result that we had, we put in PhysRev letters a few months ago. We've written a family of papers, and they're based on Carl Bender's original paper, which is related to something called PT theory, which is how to handle Hamiltonians which are not Hermitian. And I'll give you the answer right away. The solution to the unitarity problem in fourth order theories is that the Hamiltonian is not Hermitian. Earlier work I had done on the fourth order theory I'd done with collaborations with Aaron Davidson, and I had described my work on the cosmological constant in this paper number 9. Now, very, very quickly, if you have a theory where you have kinetic energy, quadratic, and then two more derivatives, that's a fourth order theory, then the equation of motion is just a fourth order box on phi is zero. The propagator in momentum space is 1 over k squared, 1 over k squared plus m squared, and you can partial fraction that into two terms, and lo and behold, here's the minus sign that we would ordinarily say means that the theory has a ghost. Now, the nice thing about this expression was that it asymptotically behaves at large k squared as 1 over k to the 4, and therefore is more convergent in the ultraviolet than standard gravity, which only goes like 1 over k squared. That solves the renormalizability problem, but the price you appear to pay is that you have to give up unitarity in order to cancel off that large 1 over k squared behavior. Another way of describing the same problem is to introduce the two-point function, and if you assume the standard completeness relation, sum on nn is 1, you can introduce a spectral weight, and you can then show that the two-point function obeys the Lehmann representation. Now, the point to notice here is this Lehmann representation holds for any theory. Higher derivative, 29 derivative, it doesn't matter. What appears here is always the free two-point function in two-dimensional theory, in two derivatives, second order theory. Even if this is fourth order, this one is still second order, because what matters is only the mass shell condition, and the mass shell condition, p squared equals m squared, is always a second order condition, even if the theory is a higher order theory. So from this relationship, you see you have a problem. if this term behaves just like 1 over k squared, normal free propagator, this behaves like 1 over k to the 4. How do you satisfy that? You have to let rho go negative, but rho shouldn't be negative because of the positivity of the completeness relation. So what you think a propagator should look like is the propagator should always be psi psi star over the energy difference, and therefore you anticipate to associate that minus sign with this sign. You anticipate that there will be two types of states in the theory, some with positive norm and some with negative norm, and that will be the completeness relation. So that's the standard argument. It's made without having constructed the Hilbert space. We'll now go ahead and quantize the theory and construct the Hilbert space and see that, in fact, this argument is not correct. To simplify life, I want to return to a theory that was written down as early as 1950 by Peiss and Uhlenbeck, the fourth order oscillator. I just take a state with a fixed linear three momentum, define two funny functions, omega 1 and omega 2, and the equation of motion that I had given you a moment ago, equation number 2, becomes the time-dependent equation number 11. This number 11 is a fourth order derivative equation. It's derivable from an action called the PU oscillator action, which Peiss and Uhlenbeck themselves wrote down in 1950. Do the variation of this action with respect to the coordinate z, and you get this equation of motion. However, you notice that there's a z dot, which is the canonical conjugate of z, and there's a z dot, which is the canonical conjugate of z double dot. Therefore, this is a constraint theory. To break the lift the constraint, you introduce an x, which replaces z dot. You introduce a Lagrange multiplier, work it through, and the Hamiltonian for the theory recovers this expression. Neil Barnaby told us earlier on that this expression is also the one that was first derived by Ostrogradsky in 1850. But nonetheless, what you have is an oscillator z and a canonical conjugate pz, an oscillator x and a canonical conjugate px, just what you'd expect. The fourth order derivative theory has two oscillators rather than one. These are the canonical commutators. You make a standard decomposition of the z's in terms of a's and a daggers. Then you discover in terms of that basis, the Hamiltonian is very straightforwardly diagonalized. A1 with a1 dagger gives you a commutator. A2 with a2 dagger gives you a commutator with a minus sign. One block of modes has positive norm. The other block of modes has negative norm. You have two realizations of the theory. You can take A1 and A2 to both annihilate the vacuum. Then the ground state energy is positive, but the matrix element of A2 with A2 dagger is negative, and that's the negative norm state. You can bypass that by having A2 dagger annihilate the vacuum. Then the norms are all positive, but now the minus sign here translates into states of negative energy. So there are two separate ways of realizing this theory, depending on whether A2 or A2 dagger annihilates the vacuum. One has positive norm states and an unbounded energy. The other has a bounded energy, but the price you pay is negative norm states. So it looks like you're done for. So now, to see if we are done for, we go a little bit further. We replace px by minus id by dx and pz by minus id by dz. And you can construct the state with energy omega 1 plus omega 2. That's this state here. That's just the wave function. It is the state with in the sector which is bounded below. So we look at the ground state wave function. You notice it goes like minus x squared there, and it goes like plus z squared there. In other words, this state is not normalizable. So despite the fact that we have what looks like a nice theory, the ground state energy is not normalizable. However, in order to set pz as minus id by dz in the first place, when you take this canonical commutator, you can only make that replacement if you're acting on a test function which is well behaved. In other words, in this sector, pz does not act as a Hermitian operator. To show an operator's Hermitian, you integrate by parts and you throw away the surface term. You can't do that if the wave function's not normalizable. Therefore, the momentum operator is not Hermitian in this sector. But when I made this analysis of the A's and the A daggers, I was presuming that it was Hermitian. Therefore, this is not the correct description of the sector which is bounded below. It's simply not correct to do this. Since the wave function is not normalizable, this expansion of the wave function as psi psi star is also not true. You can't expand in this form if the wave functions are not normalizable. So what we discover is the momentum operator is not Hermitian on the real axis. That means I can take a realization of this expression, replace z by e to the I theta z, underneath e to the I theta dz, and consider e to the I theta, and then you see immediately this operator is well defined when z is replaced by iz. In other words, this operator is Hermitian on the imaginary axis, or simultaneously, it is anti-Hermitian on the real axis. The assumption that it was Hermitian on the real axis was what led you to the problem. So how do we handle this? We want to replace z by minus iz and p by minus ip. So we make a similarity transformation in which z goes to minus iz, p goes to ipz. That preserves the commutator. I define new variables y and q, substitute them into my Hamiltonian of a moment ago, and what you notice is that the pzx term now becomes minus iq times x, because the pz has become iq. So this Hamiltonian is not Hermitian. So the answer to the problem was you thought you had a Hermitian Hamiltonian, you thought you had a normal space where you could use the Dirac norm. We now discover that that is not true. This Hamiltonian is not Hermitian. But nonetheless, despite the fact that it's non-Hermitian, it still has a real eigenspectrum. You have learned very early on in physics that if a Hamiltonian is Hermitian, the eigenvalues are real, but there's no theorem that says if the Hamiltonian is not Hermitian, the eigenvalues are not real. Eigenvalues can be real anyway. Hermeticity is only sufficient. There's another condition that you could find, which was introduced by Bender and his collaborators. It says take PT invariants. You see the P flips the sign of X, and the T flips the sign of I, so this Hamiltonian may not be Hermitian, but it's invariant under the product transformation P times T, and under those conditions, the Hamiltonian has real eigenvalues. So what we do is we introduce an operator, we set the Hamiltonian commutes with PT, we introduce a new variable C, which commutes with the Hamiltonian and commutes with PT, its square is 1, and you can write it as e to the q times p. That's all formalism. Carl Bender and I have constructed this q. It has this funny expression. And when you apply e to the minus q over 2h, e to the q over 2, to this Hamiltonian, what you get is p squared plus q squared plus x squared plus y squared. That's about as well behaved a Hamiltonian as you've ever seen. Everything is positive. This is two regular decoupled harmonic oscillators. Both of them have positive sign in the Hamiltonian. They have positive coefficient in the commutation algebra. They can be quantized in the usual way, and they have no states of negative norm. So in the sector of the theory where the momentum operator is not Hermitian on the real axis, the Hamiltonian is not Hermitian, but by a similarity transformation, it can be shown to be diagonalized in a perfectly acceptable form. So that's the solution to the problem. Now, what does it mean in practical terms? We took a Hamiltonian H and we applied the transformation to it, which was a similarity transform. But Q here is not IQ. This is not a unitary transform. Thank you. So we have H tilde. We can diagonalize it in terms of n tildes. H we can diagonalize in terms of n. from the H tilde H relationship, N is equal to e to the q over 2 n tilde. That's the transformation between the two bases. But when you look at the bra, what you see here is that n is equal to n tilde e to the q, because q is not Hermitian, is not unitary, and therefore the left eigenstate of H is n e to the minus q. The right eigenstate is n. The left eigenstate is n e to the minus q. The tildes are the normal oscillator obey the standard completeness relation, and therefore the original basis, the norm is not n with m. The norm is n with e to the q times m. So what we discover is you can't use the Dirac norm. There's a different norm, which is positive definite. That's the one which goes with the theory. When you write the e to the minus q as pc, c has eigenvalues plus or minus 1 because its c squared is 1, and therefore the propagator picks up this term that depends on c, and that's where the minus sign came from. The minus sign came from the fact that some operators, c squared, some states have c equals plus 1, some have c equals minus 1, but the Hamiltonian is completely well behaved. Now, last remark is that this singularity transformation, I'm sorry, the singularity transformation here is, similarity transformation is singular when you let omega 1 equals omega 2. That's the same as saying if you let m squared equal 0, you run into trouble. Therefore, you have to proceed much more carefully. Let me announce only the result. I won't do the calculation. What you discover is the non-Hermitian Hamiltonian becomes Jordan block. It becomes non-diagonalizable when you take the limit. What that means is that you can't make a similarity transformation to bring it back to a diagonal form. But nonetheless, I'll just have to state the result. The theory is unitary. The reason is you've lost some energy eigenstates. Where did they go? They went into solutions to the non-stationary Schrödinger equation. So what happens is, in the limit, the Hamiltonian becomes Jordan block. You lose energy eigenstates. Those energy eigenstates are replaced by another set of states which are not stationary, and the sum of the stationary plus the non-stationary together gives you unity time evolution. Scalar products are time independent. So even in the limit of equal frequency, the pure fourth order theory, the theory is still unitary. I refer you now to Mr. Berkowitz and Mr. Witten. The net effect is that the translation operator generates this form here, just like I showed you a moment ago, this form here. And they go on to say, this matrix is not diagonalizable. Absolutely true. This clashes with our usual experience. We're accustomed to the idea that translation generators are Hermitian operators and so can be diagonalized. However, conformal supergravity is not a unitary theory, and one symptom of this is that the translation generators are undiagonalizable. Well, it's certainly true that the translation generators are undiagonalizable, but the theory is unitary. In other words, lack of diagonalizability of a Hamiltonian does not mean a theory is not unitary. It simply means that you've got to include the states which are not solutions to the eigenvalue equation, namely the non-stationary states, and that makes conformal gravity and conformal supergravity at superconformal extension makes them into perfectly bona fide unitary theories. And therefore, I think for the first time, we have the possibility of constructing a consistent theory of quantum gravity in the four space-time dimensions that we have some evidence for. Thank you.
Exquisite timing. You finished right on the 20-minute mark. I think we have time for a quick question.
I just wanted to be sure if I understand this, because I could think about the problem before quantization. I can already see the issue. It's just a purely classical problem of stability. Is there a way to see what's going on just without talking about quantization, just a classical dynamics problem?
If you take the classical theory and you did something that you can't do in classical theory, you said, I'll take one set of oscillators to be real and the other set of oscillators to be pure imaginary, then you would have found the energy was bounded below.
So the way out of Mr. Ostrogradsky's theorem is he's presupposing that all the momentum and position operators are real. However, we're not interested in classical mechanics, we're interested in quantum mechanics, and their operators can be Hermitian or anti-Hermitian. But if you ask me, what's the classical theory that would be related to it? It would be a very funny classical theory in which the coordinate x was real and the coordinate z was pure imaginary. And you can see what's happening is the minus z squared term, I'll just be very quick. What's killing you here is that this minus z squared term is the one that kills you in the classical theory. But if z is pure imaginary, then this becomes a bounded potential. So the answer is yes, even in the classical theory you can save it, but you can't save it if you work with real coordinates.
So, quick follow-up. So then, if you try to make the classical theory, then do you have to abandon things like a well-defined Cauchy problem? And
oh, no. Everything else is perfectly okay. There's a well-defined Cauchy problem, but you have an earlier problem, and that is you need to define the sector of space-time where the theory is well-defined, and then you do the Cauchy problem within contours that contain that region alone. Those contours were first written down by Stokes, and they're called Stokes wedges. Every theory you've ever met, which is second order, the Stokes wedges can always include the real axis. In this case, they don't. The Stokes wedges go around to the imaginary axis. And that's all the work that Carl Bender and his PT people have been doing. This is a long program, and I gave you there's a big review he's written, which is the one that covers all of this. Yes. But everything is okay. It's just not very canonical. Yes.
Does it mean to gravity?
Yes.
Do you need a complex metric, a complex coordinates?
No. The choice you have here is very, very interesting. G mu nu is not measured in gravity because it always appears quadratically. There's always one lower G and there's one upper G. A Christoffel symbol is an upper G and a lower G. A Riemann tensor is a derivative of a Christoffel symbol. So the result of that is, if you were perverse enough to replace G by IG, nothing would change in classical gravity. So the only issue is, what does the quantum field look like, and what's the classical field that you associate with it? Yes, but the answer is, if you could do that, it could be that the solution to gravity is the statement that the gravitational field is anti-Hermitian rather than Hermitian. And if that's the solution, it's no surprise that it took 80 years to find.
Since we started a bit late, we've gone a little bit over, so maybe you could talk about the topic. Mm-hmm. So, right, well, and let's thank you.